You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
Let's go to the microscope and look at one of nature's simpler animals. An amoeba.
Welcome to episode 206 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Lee Grice from the Never Seen podcast to discuss a 1978 film that features a pre-Cheers appearance by Pixar's lucky charm, John Ratzenberger. Starring Doug McClure, Peter Gilmore, and Shane Rimmer, directed by Kevin Connor. It's Warlords of Atlantis. But first...
Ours is a rich and variant land. We are a prospering people. Wherever we live or earn our livelihood, we have bounties beyond those known to the people of any other day. And as responsible as anyone else for the care of these bounties is...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Welcome to your favorite drive-in theater and a sparkling new season. Watch our screen and local newspapers for all the fine shows coming this way. Show after show will feature the latest hits, the biggest stars for fun-filled, pleasure-packed evenings. Relax, come as you are, and spend an enjoyable night out with the entire family. No parking problems, no babysitting problems. And there are always tasty snacks at our modern refreshment stand.
Thanks, folks. And once again, welcome back.
Hi, folks. I'm Rico.
Oh, Nacho.
He's Peppy.
Si.
You can find us at the concession stand in the lobby.
Along with all sorts of other tasty goodies.
Si.
Rico's Nachos, a refreshingly new and different snack discovery. Chock full of high-quality ingredients, crisp, fresh tortilla chips, covered with creamy aged cheddar cheese, topped off with zesty jalapeno pepper rings. Rico's Nachos, out of sight.
Remember, folks, we're the new star at the snack bar. Rico's Nachos, a new taste treat you can't beat.
See?
Rico's Nachos, on sale at the snack bar now.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time, soon to be released. drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Now, for the first time, the screen unleashes a new dimension, a majestic new power, unmatched in motion picture entertainment, Hercules Unchained. The mightiest man of all time in fabulous feats of human strength the screen has never seen before. Hercules Unchained. Unfolding strength beyond belief. Flooding the big motion picture screen with wonders that dazzle the eye. See the mammoth war of the chariots. Hordes of charioteers locked in deadly combat. The arena of tigers. As Hercules fights raging jungle beasts to save his beloved. The world's strongest man in hand-to-hand battle with the giant of the valley. The Court of Lovers, a palace of flaming desire. Where the magic waters of forgetfulness drive Hercules into the willing arms of the temptress queen Lydia, a living love goddess.
I don't want to talk about sad things when I'm so happy. I love you. And to me, that's all that counts.
Hercules Unchained.
Simon, King of the Witches, starring Andrew Prime. A totally new kind of movie experience.
I'll open this mirror at 1:33. The precise moment in time when the gods are unable to resist my thrust into their domain. Charge! Charge! Charge!
Here is the modern day story of a witch, a warlock. With the Black Mass, the Witch's Coven, the curses, the terror, the fears.
The fear! The fear and rain for her!
Simon, son of evil and darkness.
You got a chance.
Simon, King of the Witches, starring Andrew Prine and Brenda Scott from the Fanfare Corporation. Rated R.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. 3, 2, 1, showtime!
What was that?
It's amazing. A living plaster. In this day and age. If only I could name it.
Oh, don't bother. Whatever it is, it's trouble.
Yes, it's an anti-arc battery on the piss. Oh, idiot, don't do that. You'll frighten it away.
Well, I'm not going to invite him in for tea, Charlie. Come on, we're getting out of here. Oh!
Yes, Father? It's a placiderm.
Oh, yes.
Are you all right? It's coming back more. Ah.
Shut up, I used to.
Just do as I say. And I tell you, pull that switch. Pull it. Not now. Wait.
Okay, our movie this time is Warlords of Atlantis from 1978, and joining me to discuss this film is Lee Grice from the Never Seen podcast. Lee, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's always nice. Always been a treat. I should, as usual, apologize up front for my accent. I'm from the West Midlands in England. I can't help it. This is what I sound like. There's nothing wrong with your equipment.
Don't worry about it at all. You know, I actually, it's funny because I am from originally the Midwest of the United States, which when I was in college and studying broadcasting and things like that, they said to me, you've got what is considered in the industry no accent. So that's good. But, you know, it's like technically I do. I mean, if I really start talking about Chicago or things like that, probably little hints of the accent come out. But I guess by broadcasting standards, I have no accent.
Okay. Well, you're fine for me. I'm well used to your accent. And that, you know, but even people in Britain have trouble with the West Midlands accent. So it's from the same kind of area of the country that Ozzy Osbourne's from.
Oh, so, okay.
You know, if you can understand Ozzy Osbourne, good luck. If you can't, even more luck.
Well, I half the time I can't understand Ozzy Osbourne, but I can understand you much better.
I'm sober, so we're okay.
Oh, yes, that helps, definitely. Well, why don't you take a moment here, remind everybody about who you are and what you do.
Okay, well, currently I'm part of a podcast called Never Seen, which I do with my friends Jenny Newman and Stacey Taylor. It's relative. I consider it like relatively new, but we've been going for a year and a half now. And basically, each month we watch a movie that we've never seen that we probably should have by now. You know, some kind of classic or a cult classic or a super popular movie, and we pick one that one or more of us haven't seen. And we watch it for the first time and just see how it hits us. So this came from, like I say, Jenny and Stacey are good friends of mine. We've known each other for years. And I was just getting so frustrated because we'd have conversations as friends. And I'd drop some kind of pop culture reference or some movie reference. And they'd go, I've never seen that. and I'd be like, what? What do you mean you've never seen Blade Runner? Yeah. What do you mean you've never seen Rear Window? All this kind of stuff. And eventually, I think it was probably during the pandemic, we got talking about, we could do a podcast about this because this is ridiculous. And merely as a way of getting them to watch movies that I think they should see, we decided to do it as a podcast. So, and it's been good fun. And we've been getting them to watch The Great Escape. We've just recently did a Christmas special on Disney's Beauty and the Beast, which was one that I'd never seen before.
That blew me away because that's one that, you know, like I cannot claim to have never seen that at all. It's very much a touchstone film for me because that was the movie that I took my future wife to on our first date. We saw Beauty and the Beast. So,
yeah. So this is exactly this is what it's like. Yeah, you know, I'll drop these things, and I'm like, "How can you have not seen that?" You know, and there's not many. There's a handful that I've not seen, but that was a big one. Probably the biggest, most obvious movie I think that I've never seen is Trainspotting. Now we haven't done Trainspotting yet, but it should be on the list at some point. We ought to get around to that at some point.
Talk about where you can't understand the accents. I mean, come on.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, I mean, I don't know. I assume that's subtitled. That's got to be subtitled, right?
I got to watch it with the subtitles on. Yeah.
But it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, almost accidentally, we kind of fell into the rhythm of picking our favorites for the others to watch, which is very dangerous ground if you're a film buff. Then you're picking, you know, a personal favorite and they're watching it for the first time because you don't know how well it's aged. You can't judge that when you've seen it before, you know, when you've grown up on it. So I picked very early on The Great Escape, you know, which was, you know, I've seen since I was a kid. I've seen it 100 times, big favorite. And that one didn't go down too well with the ladies.
Oh, interesting.
So you kind of think, we kind of joke about, can our friendship survive this? And every now and again, it gets a bit close. You think, well, I don't know. There's some reassessing of characters goes on occasionally.
I've gotten the impression from other friends of mine, other podcasting buddies that are in the UK, that The Great Escape is kind of an important film for a lot of folks in the UK.
It's a huge movie. It's like a cornerstone movie of Britain, really. And it's a big TV movie. So it's shown most bank holidays, usually on Boxing Day, you know, just after Christmas or over the Christmas holidays. Just about everybody grows up with it of a certain generation. So of my generation, I'm in my 50s. The ladies are in their 30s, I want to say, early to mid 30s. So there's a slight generation gap there and just enough to make a difference, I think.
But
I'm sure there's a gender, you know, boys definitely grow up on particularly boys of my generation grew up on like war movies and that kind of thing.
Oh yeah. Well, and I mean, it's a man's movie, isn't it? I mean, there's hardly any ladies in it. Are there any ladies in it? I'm trying to remember.
I think one might walk past at one point.
Yeah.
In fact, I think there is. I think there's a scene where there's during the escape. I think it's David McCallum's character's in the train station, and there's a woman there, and there was one of the producers when it was being made wanted her skirt shorter or something like that, or wanted some kind of romantic subplot or something. There was an issue. I remember there was some kind of issue about getting a girl, a pretty girl, in there or something, and I don't think that lasted too long.
Yeah.
But that's filmmaking in the 60s, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, before we get to our movie that we have today here, just a quick little side journey here, because, you know, I know you're a big movie guy, but I also know you're very big when it comes to print, when it comes to comics. I've asked you before when you're on the show, and I ask you again, what you're reading right now when it comes to the world of comics.
Well, I mean, I've kind of fallen away over the last few years, again, particularly since the pandemic. I think everybody during the lockdowns and stuff sort of fell into their comfort food all the time, you know. You're watching your favorite movies, and I went back and was reading my favorite comics and all that kind of stuff. And I've kind of fallen away from kind of current comics and gone back into the archives, and I've sort of concentrated on reading old stuff and stuff.
That's okay. Nothing wrong with that.
So yeah, I mean, I think my collection is something like 50,000 comics at the moment. So I kind of at a point where I sort of went, maybe I should just say that's it now. That's the collection, and it's just about filling the gaps. I do buy some current comics. There's one out at the moment called Petrol Head. That's like a science fiction thing about a robot, a robot road race, and like one of the veteran robot drivers in there helps a young girl and a scientist dad escape from the dystopian city and all that. That's cracking. That's fantastic. If you like, you know, 70s style sci-fi and things like 2000 AD and Death Race 2000 and that sort of thing. That's a real corker. That's brand new. But at the moment, obviously, it's just gone Christmas. We're just in the post Christmas period as we record. So I've got myself a box of Christmas comics that I reread, you know, every year. And I've just started a big read through of Lone Wolf and Cub, the manga.
Oh, yeah.
So I've kind of dipped in and out of that since I was a teenager, but it's been hard to pick up a real solid run. It originally came out from First Comics in the 80s, and then Dark Horse reprinted it in the 90s, I think, and then they did like omnibus editions in the early 2000s. And I've managed to pick up bits and pieces from all of those, but not got a complete run. So just before Christmas, I sort of set myself down and went, right, we're gonna read this now properly, start to finish. So that's what I've just read, volume one. I've bought volumes two and three, and then I've sort of set myself a task of getting through that lot next year. It's just magnificent stuff, and it's one of those things. I can't believe I'd never finished reading this.
Well, and talk about filling in the gaps too. I mean, I have had the Criterion set of the films for some time and have not finished it. I'm only like halfway through, so I gotta fill in the gaps myself when it comes to those movies, because the ones that I have seen are wild. They're
wild. Mental.
Yeah.
So I've got the box set as well, and I think I've only got about halfway through, and I thought like, yeah, I need to finish those off, but. Yeah. But it is. It's just an incredible, incredible read and incredible watch, those movies.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, let's get on with this movie we have here today. Going back to 1978, this is called Warlords of Atlantis. Directed by Kevin Connor, a British filmmaker who did a lot of different jobs over his career, started working mainly in documentary films, and then eventually was a sound editor for a number of well-known British directors, and then eventually got his chance to direct his own films. And he's mainly known for fantasy type stuff, which is the realm we're in with this. A number of the films he made were with the UK's Amicus Productions, which is a studio that, you know, I admit, as an American, I don't know as much about, but from what I've seen, it was kind of a short, but at least for fans, celebrated filmography they have there, mainly like genre films, fantasy and horror and such. Yeah. But some of the things he directed were films like The Land That Time Forgot, At the Earth's Core, The People That Time Forgot. So yeah, definitely in the fantasy realm. He also hit some other genres there. Probably the film he's most remembered for is the 1980 horror film Motel Hell. And then he also did a few years after that another horror film called The House Where Evil Dwells, which I saw a few years back, and I described it as basically being the Amityville Horror mixed with a samurai movie. So.
Yeah.
Now,
you had to do titles back then, right?
Oh, yeah, geez. We should also mention that this film was written by Brian Hales, who wrote a number of things, but he's probably best remembered as a writer for Doctor Who. And in fact, he created the character of the Toymaker, which was just recently revived on the new David Tennant Doctor Who specials that aired December. So yeah. Now this film, it takes place around the turn of the century, the 20th century, that is.
I made the same mistake. Oh yeah, turn of the century, but the previous one, not the
right
one.
Exactly. So we start things on a ship that's called the Texas Rose, and we've got this archaeologist named Charles Atkin, played by Peter Gilmore, and he's also got his elderly professor father there with him. They have hired the crew of this ship to take them out to sea. Everybody kind of thinks they're just searching for exotic fish and stuff like that, but they are actually in search of course, Atlantis. Now, I got to mention, too, before I get too far into it, one of the crew members of this ship is played by Cliff Clavin himself, Pixar's own John Ratzenberger. So, yeah. On the ship, we've also got this guy named Greg Collinson, played by Doug McClure, who actually appeared in a number of Kevin Connor's films. But he is this guy who designed and built for the scientists this high-tech diving bell so they can go under the surface and explore. I say high tech, but it's really, I mean, by our standards, it's pretty low tech, but
yeah,
you know, it is what it is. Yeah. So Atkin and Collinson, they go under the water and are, you know, exploring around. They're quickly attacked by a dinosaur-like sea monster. But once they get rid of this creature, they dive deeper and discover this giant gold statue. Which, you know, is like, ooh, this is possibly from Atlantis, whatever. They bring it back up on the boat, which causes the crew to start to think, well, hey, let's ditch these science guys and just go for the gold. And they end up cutting the lifeline to this diving bell, so it sinks. And they shoot the old professor, and you know, looks like they're going to try and make a run for it. But before they can make a getaway, the ship is attacked by a giant octopus, and the crew is dragged to the bottom of the sea. Now, long story short, Atkin...
End of the first 20 minutes of the movie.
Yeah. So... next thing that happens, of course, we've got Atkin, Collinson, and the crew all end up in this underwater cavern where they find that there is, of course, a whole society that exists. Yep, of course, it's the Atlanteans. Now, these Atlanteans are not your kindly, peace-loving types. In fact, they've been dragging the crews of various sea vessels down to their level here for ages, enslaving the crews to do all their dirty work for them. And among the slaves, our heroes end up meeting the daughter of a former sea captain. Her name is Delphine, played by Leah Brody. And, of course, Collinson quickly develops the hots for her. Now, the Atlanteans have no interest in most of the crew, other than to make them slaves. But Atkin has potential. He has the intelligence that is worthy of being one of them. So they drag him off to meet their Council of the Elite, one of whom is played by Sid Charisse, and they show him their great technological city and give him a preview of the utopia they wish to create one day when they take over the surface. Collinson and the others, though, they're hip to the Atlanteans' nefarious plans, so they must then rescue Atkin and find a way back to the surface. Along the way, there are treacherous swamps and a variety of nasty monsters to contend with. So, Lee, I'm going to let you get us started on this one. Give us a few of your thoughts on Warlords of Atlantis.
Okay, so I first learned about this on my 8th birthday, 1978, the day I went to see Star Wars for the first time. My dad took me to see Star Wars on my 8th birthday, and there were lobby cards. When we were going in, there were lobby cards for Warlords of Atlantis. And I was completely struck. There was one in particular that had the crew, where you see the crew walking through the swamps and they're being attacked by the flying piranhas.
That was my favorite scene.
isn't it just an 8-year-old couldn't have written a better scene than that? That's just like perfect for a kid. So, and I was just smitten. So I saw Star Wars, completely blown away by Star Wars, but always had in my head, well, this Warlords of Atlantis is clearly going to be better than Star Wars. It's just, that's got flying piranhas and these giant monsters that come out the swamp and these massive dinosaur things that climb up the walls and all this. So it was, but I didn't actually see it until a few years later when it was on TV. Now, here's a fun thing that I found out when I was doing my research, right? We're recording this now on the 30th of December, 2023, obviously. Mm. I first saw this on TV on the 30th of December, 1983.
Oh, so wonderful.
It's the 40th anniversary of me seeing this movie for the first time. That wasn't deliberate. I didn't plan this at all. This just completely just popped up, which is just a phenomenal coincidence. But yeah, so I saw it on TV. I'd kind of known about it in between those two points, me learning about it in 78 and in 83. It's one of those films that was kind of a bit everywhere. Now, whether this is just like the UK or what, I don't know, but it was kind of like a big film in the UK.
Yeah, from what I can tell, I think it was much bigger in the UK than in the US. It is a UK production, so yeah.
Yeah. It's much more well-known, and it's become like a TV perennial, much like The Great Escape, like we were talking earlier. It's on TV almost all the time, you know, every bank holiday. It was on TV over Christmas here, and, you know, so you can't not have seen, you know, people of my generation, my age, would have definitely have seen it many, many times. Doug McClure was a big hero. He was a big star. It was only, you know, and he seemed to be everywhere when we were kids, because he did four of these movies, and it felt like he did a lot more. Like, it was only a few years back. I kind of looked into it going, oh, you know, I've seen these ones he's done. How many did he do? Because it felt like he made a career of these fantasy adventure movies, and he only made the four. It's like, really? And you go to my friends and go, do you know he only had the four? I go, no, he must have made at least 10, right? He must have made at least 10.
And I think most or all of them were with director Kevin Connor, I think.
Yeah, it was literally that little run. He did the three with Amicus. Actually, he did the four with Amicus. Three with Amicus. Yeah, the Land That Time Forgot, People That Time Forgot, At the Earth's Core, which is probably my favourite of the bunch because that's got Peter Cushing in, and then Warlords of Atlantis. So, yeah, and that's the four. And then I think he did a couple of horror movies later that were kind of more grown up. But it's an interesting little subset of fantasy movies. This was by EMI, but it feels like an Amicus movie. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's definitely an Amicus movie in all but, you know, fact, to be honest, because it feels very much a part of the same group as the previous fantasy movies. But it's just one of those films that's just been around. It's just part of the wallpaper growing up in the 80s. But it is just a really fun movie. It's not particularly sophisticated. Technically, it's not sophisticated, really. You kind of look at it and go, this came out the same year as Star Wars, and you can see,
well, yeah.
There's a difference there, definitely, you know.
Well, and I think that's one of the interesting things about it, because as I was thinking about it here, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that you first became aware of this when you saw Star Wars for the mm-hmm. first time. And to me, watching this, I'm going, this feels like it should be a pre-Star Wars film.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of just the type of story that they're telling and how they execute it. And I'm not trying to slam the way they executed it at all. You know, I mean, Star Wars was a huge leap forward when it comes to special effects, and everybody had to catch up. You know, so the things they're doing here when it comes to the matte paintings and, you know, the bizarre futuristic sets with the Atlanteans and all that, and the monster such. I mean, it feels more like something that should have come at least 5, I'd even say 10 years earlier. Yeah. It feels
early 60s, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's actually the type of film where I thought, like, this is what, like, Ray Harryhausen would be working on a few years earlier than this. Now, of course, the way they execute the monsters, and we'll talk more about the monsters in depth here as we go, but, you know, it's not stop motion. This is primarily like suitmation and puppets and that type of stuff. And it's got a great charm to it, but it's not like the way Harryhausen would have executed it. I'm sure if this had been in someone's hands like Harryhausen, it would have been like, whoa.
Yeah. It's interesting. On Twitter a while back, I did a poll because I was watching again during. I keep hopping back to the pandemic and the lockdowns, but I watch a lot of movies in the lockdowns. I put a poll on Twitter about, you know, other than CGI, what was your favorite type of dinosaur? Was it stop motion? Was it the puppets, or was it where they just stuck bits onto a lizard? You know, because those seem to the way they did it. You know, they. And it was interesting that the stop motion came top by a long shot. And then you had the puppets, and then nobody liked the real lizards with horns and fins stuck on them. But you kind of forget that they had to really just, how do you bring a dinosaur to life if you can't just do it in a computer? You know, that was a hard job. So, but it is interesting to, and we'll probably get to this a bit more later on, that although it came out the same, you know, came out the same year as Star Wars, or around the same time, the technology that they're using is basically the same as what they did in Star Wars. You know, the Rancor and Return of the Jedi is still just a rod puppet.
Right, yeah.
You know? But it's just they had more money and they were pushing the tech forward and creating the interactivity with the, you know, with the actors and stuff like that, you know, and there's more detail. Like, one thing, and I do like the monsters in this, but the one thing you notice is they don't really do anything. They kind of, this when they go through the swamp, this big, like, fish lizard creature leaps out and just sort of stands there and looks a bit threatening.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
there's no real interaction with them. And you think, well, that's the struggle they kind of had, you know. if you can't do Harry, if you can't get Harryhausen to do it for you, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can definitely, it's that case where the monsters are often feeling like they're kind of in a different world than the humans are. There's not as much interaction. And that is, I'm sure, because of the limits of the technology. Now, like you said, Harryhausen, he would have done it. Harryhausen was always looking for those opportunities to get it in there. He'd make a little puppet person and have that all happen. Here, they probably just didn't have the budget or the skill or whatever. So like in that first scene where they're walking through the swamp and that fish lizard type of thing, I thought he looks a little bit like the creature from the Black Lagoon's ugly cousin or something like that. You know,
Big Brother.
When he first pops out, he just kind of pops out and growls and such, and there's a big splash of this oily looking water and stuff, and it's cool looking, but they just kind of like, all right, just kind of stand still for a second, and then he goes away. And they're like, all right, let's go, you know. And it pays off later because the beast does come back again in the third act. But, you know, it's just kind of the thing. It's like, well, wait, no, there needs to be more than that.
Yeah, that's it. You just think they could just go, you expect the Atlanteans to just go, just ignore him. Just ignore him. He just likes to show off. Just ignore him and he'll go away. Don't worry about it.
I suppose we should probably expand more on the monsters since we went there first. It's just, and it's hard not to go there first because I think that's definitely one of the highlights of this. And I mean, certainly, going back to like when you are talking about seeing this for the first time, an 8-year-old being like, whoa, that's the thing you're going to remember from a movie is the monsters.
As a kid at that time, you didn't really notice the difference. It was like, this is just awesome. It's a monster movie. What more do you want? You know?
Yeah. I mean, where we want to start there with that. I mean, I guess what works best for you when it comes to the monsters?
Well, I think that they're nice designs for a kickoff. I think they are just kind of, like I say, they have been. I mean, what's the name of the guy who did the monsters? Roger Dickin is responsible for the models and stuff. And I think they are nice designs, and they look suitably aquatic. And I think they're supposed to be mutants. Mm-hmm. I think it's revealed later that they're kind of in a little bit of exposition that they're mutations of regular sea creatures or something. And they're kind of nice. You've got like there's a giant octopus in there, which was that scene where the giant octopus attacks the boat. That was a really popular clip amongst like children's TV shows. If there was children's TV shows that were doing things about, like there was a show called Screen Test, which was like a kids quiz show about movies, in the 70s and early 80s, and that was a popular clip to show. It was a good fun kid pleaser, that the giant octopus attacking the boat. It's not too scary, but it's kind of cool looking. Now with adult eyes, you realize you can see how it's being done. Clearly, they're just rubber tentacles that have been pulled around with, chicken wire or whatever, fishing line. But there's no real life to the tentacles that you'd get like with CGI or something. It's all down to the actors to look scared, and to wrap it around themselves that kind of.
I would say they pull it off pretty well, though.
Yeah, they do a good job. I think there's some bits and pieces. I mean, it helps when you've got a good cast. I mean, you've got like a really good cast of character actors in this. Like you've mentioned John Ratzenberger, I only kind of discovered him with Cheers, to be honest. That was it. But it was like, I can't remember now if I saw Cheers before I saw this. I think Cheers might have been a couple of years later, but you watch it now and you go, he's really giving this his all. He's not just in it for the check. He's making the most of this.
And he's nasty. He's a bad guy, pretty much, which that's something we probably need to discuss in a little bit. It's just there's a weird dynamic between kind of the scientists and the crew members and things like that. But I want to stick with the monsters for a bit.
Had you seen this before? Is this a film you'd seen?
Oh, no. This is new. This was new for me. This is the first time watch. So, yeah. I was 8 years old. You're right. Yeah.
How you got this as a grown man, as a grown adult.
I think kind of what I was saying before, where some parts of the film maybe were a little dry for me when it comes to just the exposition, all that. It's saving grace is the monsters, you know, it's fun stuff. And, you know, you mentioned that octopus attack. There's one at the beginning of the film and, you know, not to spoil too much, but there's one at the end of the film. I think the one at the end of the film is great. I mean, it's just, you know, just total destruction of the boat and the octopus. I love that the octopus is like, seems to be driven by trying to get the gold statue that they brought on board. You know, it's like, you know, Ratzenberger wants the gold, but so does the octopus, you know.
Nobody states that, but as a kid, you can tell. It's clear from the storytelling that's what the octopus is after, which is, I think it's to its credit, you know, anybody can figure that out.
And it's great the way that it grabs the statue and it's like almost like swinging it around like a baseball bat and stuff, and knocking things over. It's fun.
Yeah, when he gets it, he's still going, no, I've got this back, but you're still going to be punished. I'm still going to trash the joint.
Exactly. So, yeah, and I mean, you mentioned the big monster, the kind of, you know, like we say, the thing that looks like the Gill Man or whatever, you know. It's got some good moments. I mean, that is actually the second encounter with that creature is one of the a bit more gruesome moments of the scene, because he actually does manage to slurp somebody down, which, you know, as a kid, that always horrified me.
it horrifies me more as an adult. As a kid, I thought, of course he's going to eat the people. That's what monsters do. You just accept it. As an adult, you go, oh, that's a really horrible way to go. His legs are still kicking. He's still alive. Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly. I want to talk, too, about these weird things. I don't even know how to describe them, where, you know, they basically just kind of randomly come and attack the slave city at one point. They look kind of like, I don't know, turtles. They remind me a bit of Gamera from Japanese kaiju films. But, you know, almost like these giant, spiny, snapping turtle things that come and attack the city. And, again, I mean... You know, a little clunky, but it's a fun sequence. And I think one of the things I really liked about it, one of its great charms, is that you have these slaves that have been captured by the Atlanteans, and they're basically left to fend for themselves. And they're, you know, having to like pull in old cannons from sunken ships to try and shoot at these things. And they're throwing rocks and spears and things like that. And it's, you know, I don't know. There's just a great charm to the low tech attack on these giant beasts.
And I really like that it's like vertical. They're climbing up these kind of vertical walls, so it's like a vertical battle, which you don't get very often. I think somebody at Lucasfilm must know this, because a similar battle turned up in one of the Star Wars movies. I think it might have been Clone Wars, one of the Clone Wars animated show. Their pilot movie had a similar vertical. With these walkers going up the wall, but I think that's really not a really different take on that kind of battle, where, you know, obviously you've got the medieval aspect where they're chucking fireballs down and oil and throwing spears and stuff, but it's actually got a lot going for it, to be fair. I think that's quite a unique action set piece. Like I say, there's not a lot of interaction, although there is one bit where one of these big dinosaur things like conveniently smashes down the wall to the cell where the characters are being imprisoned and they can get out. And there's a nice little combination there of rear projection of the creature's head and a giant prop hand that comes through the wall to smash it down. And I thought, although you can tell how that's done, I thought that's quite a neat bit of filmmaking, to be fair. I'll give them credit for that. That was a nice little job, you know, and any bit of interaction between the monsters and the humans is just welcome, because there's not a lot of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, and those are some of the moments that were the most fun for me. I'm always kind of looking for where puppets are used. I've mentioned it on the show many times. I have a history as a puppeteer. I've worked as a puppeteer for a long, long time. And so I'm always intrigued to see where the art of puppetry is used in special effects. And there's a lot of moments here where you get various forms of puppets. Really the first monster encounter is primarily a puppet, where they have this, you know, sea creature, this sea dinosaur, or whatever you want to call it, that attacks the little submersible thing. And I thought it was great, you know, because I mean, like we said, it's essentially a diving bell. So it's got this open bottom, you know, where they, you know, the water is there. And I've always thought that just looks like the most dangerous thing in the world. I don't know how that, you know, I wouldn't want to go down in that.
Well, it's interesting. As a kid, I was astonished by the fact that the diving bell had an open bottom, right?
Yeah.
And I remember in school, you know, in science, we had the thing about, if you turn a cup upside down and put it under water, the air can't, you know, stays in the cup and all that kind of stuff. And I watched Warlords of Atlantis with my 5-year-old niece a few weeks back. And she was astonished, as I was, that the diving bell had an open bomb. She was like, well, how does the water not come in?
Yeah.
And I think that's still, and that's a real thing. And they go, no, that they're not making that up. That's what it is. As long as the air pressures, that's why they need the pipes, the air pumps and stuff like that. It keeps it out. And I still think that's a lovely bit of kind of like real bit of science that she's just still kind of entertaining and kind of mind boggling.
Yeah. Well, and then I love that, you know, because we have that means that this monster, this dinosaur, could stick its head up through the hole.
Stick its head right through it. Yeah, it's good. Like this full size dinosaur head. Not a lot of, you know, kind of life to it, but it's still, you know, it's kind of neat that's there and there. You can see how much it just fills up the diving bell when it comes in and all that.
It's very effective. It's pretty neat. It's great. And I got to talk to, before we move away from the monsters, I kind of hinted at it before, but my favorite bit when it comes to the monsters in this movie is these flying piranha, as you described, where they're going through this swamp. And, I mean, they've already been attacked by the Gillman's giant older brother. They've already been attacked by some other weird lizards that are grabbing their legs out of the water and such. And then suddenly these fish start shooting out of the water, and it's great. There's like sound effects, almost sounds like they're being shot out of a cannon or something like that. And these fish are going right for people's throats, grabbing on and stuff. And I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Isn't it just so 70s though? Because I remember as a kid being convinced that piranhas were going to be a big threat, like lava and quicksand. As a kid, you just assumed these things are going to be a big danger in your life, and of course they're not, but you just think, yeah, piranhas were there. And I must have been aware of piranhas through various, you know, Tarzan movies, I guess, and stuff like that, because I knew what piranhas were. And I remember thinking, oh my god, these piranhas can fly. You're doomed. You don't even have to be in the water.
Being a huge fan of puppetry and the Muppets in general, seeing that made me think of the character of Lou Zealand. The boomerang of fish! I throw the fish away! And they come back to me! I was like, yeah, Lou Zealand's under there throwing the fish at these guys.
It is just, like I say, again, it feels like they knew their audience, I think, when they were making it. They knew they were making it for, you know, 10-year-old kids who that was of the age who knew what their threats were, you know.
I suppose we've talked about the monsters a lot here. We need to give some time to the humans.
If we both. I mean,
so I guess let's talk first about just kind of the basic human part of the story here. I mean, forget the monsters, but the whole just encountering Atlantis, this other culture, their nefarious plans, all that. I guess, you know, when monsters aren't on screen, what's your take on this film?
Well, it's interesting because I was watching it and I was going, the actual plot of this movie is very bog standard. It's your standard adventure plot number one. I call it the Flash Gordon template. It's like arrival, capture, escape, battle.
Yes.
There's your four little acts. That's it. And you can, you know, and I call it the Flash Gordon template, but it probably goes back to, you know, John Carter, Edgar Wright Brothers,
sure.
You know.
Yeah.
But it's that's what it makes me think of. And, you know, you could take the Flash Gordon movie and overlay this, and you've still got the same, you know, beats at the same point, you know, capture, escape. You know, so that's, you know, the actual bit in the middle is kind of just get on to the next monster. What I'd really like as an adult now is kind of like the bookends. is the kind of like the rebellion on the ship of the crew. There, you know, it's only like two movies or like one movie with like a big monster movie wedged in the middle. So I like the fact that, you know, you've got this this subplot about the crew turning against the professor and so on, trying to kill them. And then the fact they picked that up at the end, because they could have just let that go. Oh, well, we're all friends now. We've all gone through this horrible experience. But they go, no, we're back and we're still going to carry on and we're still going to sort this out. So I like I like the structure of it.
Yeah, through the center of the film, you you kind of almost get the impression like, oh, okay, well, we're just we're not gonna tell Atkin that, that we shot his father up and you know everybody's gonna be buddies and it'll all be okay in the end because we overcame this big situation. But yeah, once they get back on lot on the ship and they see the gold again, there's it's like, oh, okay, well, hey, you know, back to plan A, you know.
Yeah, that's done. That that little inconvenience happened. So we'll just get back now to what we were doing before, which is stealing the gold and get rid of you guys. But it's I just really like that. I think that adds a nice little, like I say, that the main core story is very, you know, conventional. There's nothing, no great twists or anything there, to be honest. But you've got these things, these bookends that I really like, where you know, where everybody's just, you know, it's like a completely different little heist movie on either
end. I do think that the Atlantis stuff in the middle, there are some intriguing aspects to it. It was a little strange at first because they spent a lot of time in this, you know, slave city. And I mean, part of the idea here is that there's seven different cities that made up Atlantis. And some of them have, you know, sunk to the Earth's core or whatever and don't exist. And others are crumbling. And then there's this paradise where the elites live. And so a lot of our time is spent in this slave city, which is not the typical vision that you have of Atlantis in film. I mean, there's, you know, tons of films that have dealt with Atlantis. And this is very much, it's all really run down and, you know, does not look like the, oh, wow, Atlantis. I mean, it's not like what I saw in the Aquaman movie that came out a few weeks ago. Yeah. You know, it's not that kind of, you know, vision of Atlantis. But we do then get, you know, these moments where they go to this city that, where the elites live. And there's this whole bit with Atkin where they've taken him off because, you know, they sense his intellect. They think, okay, he can be one of us and all that. And they show him this vision they have of the future. They have this like magical helmet that they put on him so that he can see into the future. And they're like, we're going to show you what we want to build, you know, because their whole goal is we found out that the Atlanteans are actually from another planet. And, you know, they were here on Earth and then there was this disaster. So now they're deep inside the Earth, but they want to get back so that then they can go back into space and whatever. But to achieve that, they've got to cause the surface world to do these certain things, to have these technological achievements and whatever. And so they have Atkin wearing this helmet and he's seeing visions of, you know, what they plan. And they put all the, they use all this newsreel footage from World War II era to show this stuff. And it's the, like the thing I was not expecting for this movie at all. We basically, I mean, tell me if I'm reading this wrong, but it seems like the Atlanteans are the Nazis.
Yeah,
because they show all this footage of, you know, Nazi imagery, Hitler, etc. And they're like, this is our plan. This is the utopia we have planned. I'm like, oh, my gosh, the Atlanteans are the Nazis.
there's a whole, like I say, it, you could probably get from that synopsis, there's a whole lot of backstory. There's a whole lot of exposition. There's not really dealt with whether this was intended to be like a franchise or they were expecting to do more movies. I don't know, but there seems like there's a lot of stuff, a lot of groundwork laid down. Like I bet these multiple, you know, seven different cities and stuff like that. This not remotely touched upon really at all. They just tell you about it and then the plot moves on. They deal with it. But yeah, you've got this whole scheme. Now I don't even think until I was watching it this time for this, and I was proper paying attention, that I even picked up on their scheme before. the many, many times I've seen it before. Yada, yada, yada. Want to take over the Earth, blah, blah, blah. And now you're going, you go, oh, yeah. And I'm thinking, wait, are they saying that they're going to cause World War II? Or are they saying this is just going to happen and we're going to take advantage of it? We just need the technical advances that occur during wartime.
Right.
To rocket production or whatever. But yeah, it was like, wow. And you can tell, like I said, you can tell that this was written by a Doctor Who writer, because it's got that kind of adventure level and then this deep thought level it's kind of buried underneath.
Uh-huh.
Where they kind of go, well, this is what the story I kind of want to tell, but I've got to do all this punching and running stuff on the top. All the subtext is what we want to be text. That's the novel that I can't do. I can't write. But I've got to do all this, I've got to have Doug McClure punching Cliff Clavin instead. It's interesting that, I'm sure. I mean, it's one of those movies that I think is ripe for a remake. I think it would really work as a remake. It kind of begs for some, but at the same time, I'm thinking, yeah, but if I did it now, it'd be like 3 hours long. And it would, it'd just go on and on and on. Whereas as it exists, it's just really kind of short and tight, and it just kind of moves. And sure, there's a lot of chit chat, but at the same time, you've got, Doug McClure in a ripped shirt punching people in prison cells and monsters and stuff like that at the same time.
Well, we should talk about the cast here. I mean, Doug McClure, Peter Gilmore, these folks. I mean, I guess, how do you think they do? I mean, let's start with McClure. I mean, you were saying he was kind of a big deal on your side of the pond. So,
he was kind of on a par as a kid. I hate to say, as a kid, he was like, oh, well, obviously you've got, Harrison Ford and Doug McClure and, Johnny Weissmuller. And, he's like a big action hero, big name action hero. So it's like only as you kind of grow up, you realize, oh, he's not, he wasn't that big a star. He was kind of, he's almost like a curious choice of leading man, really. Because I think at the time he was best known for playing Trampas in The Virginian, a Western TV show, which I've never seen. That kind of finished just before I was born, or just after I was born, about 71, I think that finished. But I think it must have ran a bit longer in the UK, because we used to get American shows, a lot later back then. Now it's almost a simultaneous release. But I think he was popular. He was popular, much like I know a few shows ago you did Carry On, Follow That Camel, with kind of where they kind of imported Bilko into British cinema. I think the same thing happened, because Bilko was popular at the time, and I think the same thing with The Virginian was probably popular at the time. And sure, he was a known face. He might have even still have been on TV when they did the first of these, when they did The Land That Time Forgot. So he might have just been a very well known guy at the time. But I've still got a great affection for him. I have to say, I still, whenever one of these films pops up on TV now, I always tweet it going, Doug McClure alert, Doug McClure alert. And everybody goes, all right, thanks, I'll set my recorder and all that kind of stuff. So he's kind of, like I say, it just boggles my mind that he only did, I guess from Doug McClure's point of view, I guess he just finished The Virginian and was looking for work. And I guess somebody, one of these, the producer, I think his name was John Dark of Amicus, sort of said, hey, do you want a job? And he just went, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. He's an interesting choice, he's essentially the tough guy in this, the man's man and all that. Mm-hmm. And, I'm not as familiar with his other work in this. I knew his name and such.
Yeah.
So he doesn't necessarily conjure up certain images in my mind. The thing
that's interesting, because I wanted to ask you how well known is Doug McClure in the States? I get the feeling that he's almost like a British star more than an American star.
I think you might be right. I mean, I'm right in the same age range as you are. Mm-hmm. I was born in 71, so I don't necessarily have, you know, the firsthand familiarity with the Virginian and such. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I certainly know his name. What it's funny because actually when I hear the name Doug McClure, my brain first thinks about the character from The Simpsons that Phil Hartman played where he was Troy McClure. You know, you might remember me from such films as, you know, whatever. And, but I mean, yeah, it's not, definitely not as big a name for me. I think he's, you know, well suited to this type of role. The thing I actually think he pulls off the best in here is he's actually quite funny at times.
Yeah.
And especially it's in the interactions he has with Peter Gilmore, you know.
Yeah. It's quite a modern characterization. It feels very Marvel, actually, that he's the action guy, but he's kind of funny and he's a bit sarcastic and he takes the mic. And stuff like that, which feels almost, you know, I'd say very, you know, postmodern almost. But I apparently the director Kevin Connor said he loved working with Doug McClure because he said because he'd been doing like westerns for like 20 years or something at that point. He said he was really good at the fighting, so he knew how to throw a punch, and you know, he was really good with the fight choreography, and he knew, you know, he was really really good at that stuff and really convincing at that stuff. And there's a lot of that going on in there, you know, and it kind of like it does. You can see it. Yeah, there's some definitely some nice fight choreography. There's a fight at the end. And I think it actually might be between Doug McClure and John Ratzenberger where they have a fight on the boat. And some of the choreography seems very Raiders of the Lost Ark. There's a bit where one of the characters grabs the other one and sort of starts bashing his head against the wall. And I thought that's like a bit in Raiders of the Lost Ark where they're in the truck and Indy bashes the German's head against the dashboard. Mm-hmm. And I thought I want to check the fight choreographer who is on these movies. But I think it's kind of like fun on that level, you know. But yeah, but Doug McClure he was good at this sort of stuff. I think, you know, and it's funny because I, you know, like I say, I just assumed he'd done these for years and years and years, but he did like four and then kind of went back to the States, I guess, and had his like TV career and stuff. One thing I thought was funny, actually, when I was checking his filmography, he made a film in the 70s. Actually, it was in 71, so before these. He did a TV movie called Terror in the Sky, which is a remake of Zero Hour, which is what we reviewed, another film we reviewed.
Yeah.
That you had me on to talk. Which I thought that's a neat little link, little throwback.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who else in the cast kind of jumps out to you here? I mean, you know, it's definitely, you know, the weight of the film is on Doug McClure, on Peter Gilmore and such. The others are definitely supporting players. But are there any that kind of stand out for you?
Well, yeah. Well, Peter Gilmore is a very famous face in the UK. He was in for about 10 years. He was in a long-running TV show called The Enidian Line, which was like a period serial drama about a shipping company. So he was a very familiar face. He'd also been in a lot of Carry On movies. He'd been in about 10 or 11 Carry On movies. So he was a very familiar face. And I think he's very good. He's very good at the drama and the comedy stuff as well.
He's a good contrast to McClure, you know, because McClure's the tough guy, the man's man. Gilmore is the somewhat socially awkward, brainy guy, you know, and they have a lot of moments together and it works quite well.
Yeah, there's a nice double act there, I think. You know, you kind of think, oh, they could have pushed this a bit more. And, you know, given a couple more years, I think, when sequels became a bit more required, I think we could have seen them back again. The other guy I wanted to mention was Shane Rimmer, who plays Captain Daniels, who's the captain of the Texas Rose. Now, Shane Rimmer, again, is a famous voice more than anything else. He's a very prolific, like, character actor. He's been in a ton of stuff, and you'd have seen him in stuff even if you didn't recognize him. You know, he was in Doctor Strangelove. He was in Rollerball. He was in a bunch of Bond movies. He was in Superman 2. I think he was in Batman Begins. But he's probably most best known for the work he did with Gerry Anderson, you know, the puppet TV guy. Mm-hmm. So he did the voice of Shane Rimmer was the voice of Scott Tracy in Thunderbirds. He did a bunch of random voices for other Gerry Anderson shows. He became a writer on Captain Scarlet, which is my favorite of the Gerry Anderson adventure shows. So he was a super prolific actor. He's actually Canadian, but he called himself a rent-a-yank. He said whenever British productions need an American, they'd go to him and a couple of other guys, and they'd all just pop up and be fighting for the same roles and turn up at the auditions together and all that kind of stuff. But he's really good. He's a really strong character actor, actually. You know, it's actually a kind of a pretty good cast they've got, you know, of character actors, which I think is always a good thing to do when you've got like a low budget movie, is just fill up your cast with solid character actors who know what they're doing.
One of the things I liked about Shane Rimmer's character is that you're always a little unsure of where he stands in terms of, like, you know, is he going to kind of help out the professor and the good guys and such, or is he just going to go along with the crew who want the gold and all that kind of stuff?
Well, yeah, because I won't spoil the plot twist, because there's a bit of a plot twist at the end that I completely forgot. There's, oh yeah, we didn't know that about this character at that point. You know, there's a bit of a revelation at the end. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to you know, to really watch it, because I'm used to just sitting and having it on. It's a real comfort movie for me. So I just watch it and just let it wash over me. You know, it's like wallpaper or a cracking fireplace. You just take it in. But actually, I'm to sit down and watch it and pay attention to, you know, the structure and the characterizations and the plot stuff and that, kind of go, oh, no, there's actually quite an interesting little twist there and that character. And you kind of assume that this and that, and you find out that it's not as obvious as you think. So it's quite an interesting little play that goes on, a little whodunity kind of thing, thread that goes through it as well. And I completely forgot. When you get back to you kind of forget that there's this whole story that was going on the boat, and there's two other characters in the movie who were on the boat at the start of the film that aren't in Atlantis. And when you get back, they go, oh, yeah, I forgot about the kid. I forgot he was in the film.
And the kid has a moment there in the end, too. So, you know, that's cool. Well, we should start moving towards the break here, but just any final thoughts you have on this one? I mean, I think it's fair to say it's not quite as spectacular as it is, you know, sitting down with one of those Harryhausen epics of the 60s and such. But I guess, you know, where do you put this one?
Yeah, I very much put it alongside those on my, I mean, literally on my shelf. You've got things like The Thing from Another World and Them, and, you know, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and then you've got the Harryhausen and, you know, Jason and the Argonauts and Sinbad, and then you've got the Doug McClure movies. You know, you can actually get a box set. I had a box set for Christmas of the three. He did, which was perfectly timed. There's been a lot of spooky stuff around this recording. I have to say, a lot of coincidences and stuff have been very kind of spooky.
It was meant to be. The Atlanteans are influencing it. Yeah, it's their master plan. It's their utopia.
Born away. So it definitely goes in that. So if you're into that kind of stuff, you know, you have to kind of, as with the Harryhausen stuff, you have to just accept that it's not going to be as polished as a modern movie. But if you can watch it with a 10-year-old brain, or if you can watch it with a kid, that really helps. Like, I've been watching a lot of films with my niece. She's been big into these fantasy and horror movies all this year. It's been a thing that we've been watching. You know, we've been watching a different. So we've watched The Thing from Another World together. We've watched The Incredible Shrinking Man. We've watched Them. We've watched Frankenstein and Dracula and The Creature from the Black Lagoon and all those. And she's been loving them. We just before we recorded, we just finished watching the original King Kong. Mm. So we're having a lovely time watching all these old movies. And they're all kind of equal to her, you know, whether it's puppets or stop motion or CGI or whatever. It's all just monsters, which is a brilliant mindset to have, I think. I kind of envy that mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
To be able to watch stuff and just see it as King Kong's alive. Those monsters are alive, you know?
Yeah.
So I'd say, if you could accept that, if you can adjust your brain, I think you'll have a good time with it. And the previous ones, you know, at the US Corps, great fun. And, you know, the land that Time Forgot is great fun.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I think kind of that idea of trying to watch this with like the eyes of a child is the best way to approach it. It's not without its issues, but it is a fun film if you approach it in the right frame.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, for sure. All right. Well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another one of our podcasting friends, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
MovieMavericks.com, broadcasting current box office breakdowns, movie news, and reviews. Now for your hosts, Jason and Trevor.
Hey now, even though we're over 200 episodes deep into the Movie Mavericks podcast, it's still not too late to start listening.
Where every show we give you 10 truths, 20 lies, and a bunch of Hollywood secrets.
It's like existentialism slipping into nihilism.
MovieMavericks.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support this show and earn access to some bonus features, including a bunch of the older episodes of this show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Hi, I'm Jason Soto.
And I'm Lisa Leahy.
And we're the host of Between the Scares, a podcast that takes a look at every movie that Blumhouse Productions has made. You may not recognize the name, but they have made some of your favorite horror movies like Paranormal Activity, Ouija, and Insidious.
Yeah, Jason, but they've also made stupid movies like The Fever and Best Night Ever and Hysterical Blindness.
Yeah, those two. But they also did Whiplash, Get Out, and Us. And we're going to cover it all.
Hey! Did you know that Jason Blum also produced that Gem and the Holograms live-action movie?
He did that?
Uh-huh.
Ugh. Fine. But then you have to watch The Green Inferno. So listen to Between the Scares on Anchor, Apple, Google, Amazon, or our home location at rabbitholepodcasts.com.
For your convenience, we have an attractive snack stand with buttered popcorn, golden good and hot from the popper, sizzling hot dogs cradled in fresh, fluffy buns, ice cream, and other good things to eat.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is where we each get to talk about another movie that we've enjoyed, something that we just want to let everybody else know about so they can check it out for themselves. It might be a forgotten film, might be an old classic, might be something new in theaters, on streaming. It could be anything. So, Lee, what is your recommendation?
Well, my recommendation is, and I try to be, you know, on topic with these, I try and create a theme because I'm a conscientious podcast guest, and I've tried to keep the monster theme going, and I've chosen The Monster Club from 1981, which was an ITC production directed by Roy Ward Baker and produced by Milton Subodsky, who was a big producer with Amicus, and he was kind of best known for all these anthology movies, the portmanteau horror movies, stuff like, you know, Tales from the Crypt, From Beyond the Grave, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, that sort of thing. He also was the producer on The Land That Time Forgot and At the Earth's Core. So extra links there. And what it is, it's just another anthology horror movie. But it's probably the last one they did. It wasn't a big hit and it's not terribly successful, but I love it to pieces. And it's about a horror author. It starts off with a horror author who stumbles across a homeless guy who's very ill in the middle of the street. It's a British movie, I should say. And you've got starring Vincent Price and John Carradine. John Carradine's the horror author. And Vincent Price is this guy he stumbles across who turns out to be a vampire. And he lets the Vincent Price drink some of his blood to revive him and essentially saves his life. As a thank you, and because Vincent Price's character recognises the horror author and admires him, because he's a fictionalised version of a real horror author called R. Chetwin Hayes, who wrote a lot of horror stories and monster stories in which the monsters were quite sympathetic. And which is, of course, very popular. If you're a real monster, you appreciate that. So he offers to take John Carradine's character to a secret club where all the monsters hang out. So they go to this club and it's a real very 70s kind of hip club music. You've got live bands and stuff like that going on. And he introduces him to the monster's genealogical chart, their kind of family tree and all the different branches on this tree. So you've got werewolves, vampires, ghouls. And when they crossbreed, you've got werevamps and vamghouls and stuff like that. It's all very funny. And in the process of this, you get three more stories, three self-contained stories. There's one about a monster called a Shadmok. Then you've got one about a family of vampires. And then you've got one about some ghouls. And then you get the epilogue. And in between these stories, you get like a music act. So you've got bands performing and stuff like that. And it's just an interesting kind of amalgamation of an experiment, really. They were trying to do something really kind of hip. And I think they were trying to create like a horror movie for, not necessarily for kids, but certainly older kids, you know, young teenagers. They were going for that kind of, because 81, you know, Star Wars had come out, Empire Strikes Back had come out. And I think they were trying to hook onto that. But they didn't have the budget. It was made on for peanuts. And it has to be said, when you visualize like a monster club, you go into it and you visualize all these monsters sitting around, like the cantina in Star Wars, all these cool looking monsters. You have to put that out of your head, because these are some of the ropiest looking monsters you've ever seen in your life. Just really eyeball on springs type masks that they've just bought from like a gag shop and just put on. But there's a lot of charm to it. You know, then some of the stories are quite interesting, quite fun. You know, there's an interesting cast. You've got Vincent Price, John Carradine. You've got Donald Pleasant, Stuart Whitman, who was...
Oh, yeah. I was looking at the cast list here. I was like, whoa, you know, yeah. I mean, Stuart Whitman, Britt Eklund, Simon Ward, Patrick McNee. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. You got a hell of a cast in there. And it's just like a fun little horror movie. I saw it in 88 on TV, and I just kind of stumbled across it. And was just completely bamboozled about what is this thing? But it's what I find interesting. There's a few like background stories that are quite fun. One is that they had this idea of doing this horror story, this horror anthology, and having the best musical acts in there of the time slotted in. And they said that the problem is, if you pick the top five, you know, pop acts of any given year, the next year it'll be a completely different top five. So right. if you pick five in 1970. And you shoot at the end of 1970 to release it in 1971, by the time the movie gets released, nobody knows who they were, or they just seem like really outdated, you know?
Yeah.
So they said that kind of backfired on them. Although it is quite interesting. You've got one of the music acts is a guy called B.A. Robertson. Now, I don't know if he made it to the US at all, but he had a pretty good career in the UK. He was a Scottish singer who wrote a lot of kind of tongue-in-cheek pop hits. He did one called Bang Bang and stuff like that. It's really, you know, he was quite a good thing. And he fits really well into it, because he kind of looks like the Joker. So he kind of fits into the film anyway. And apparently UB40, who's a big band, they're on the soundtrack. They don't actually appear in the on stage in the movie, but they're there. So they were just up and coming at the time, I think. But it's so that's one aspect that's kind of fun. There's also a bit with a stripper that I think is one of my favorite sequences in any horror movie ever. And you've got the standard 70s stripper who comes on in the skimpy outfit and the tassels and the feather boa. And then she strips down and then she keeps going. So she takes off her arms and takes off her legs and, you know, takes off. So, and then she's just a skeleton. A dancing skeleton, which I thought was genius, and clearly Robbie Williams had seen that at some point and decided to turn that into a pop video. He did a pop video called Rock DJ that had which he strips down quite famous. Now he had a lot more money, and but it's still a neat little sequence. I really like that sequence.
Oh, I gotta check this thing out. It's well worth it.
I can't. I've heard... enjoy it. But it's got a lot of charm to it. It needs to be seen.
I'm familiar with it, and just mainly in terms of like the poster image. I remember on you know, seeing it on the big VHS box sitting on video store shelves. It's got a great poster with Vincent Price, and then kind of like you said, this collection of monsters that looks like something out of the Star Wars cantina.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've never pulled the trigger on this one, so yeah, I need to fix that. This looks wild. I didn't know quite the degree of what was involved with this film, so yeah, I need to check it out. Well, the film that I'm going to recommend, I do like to try and tie things in with the main film we talked about, but I struggle sometimes to find something, and I was struggling this week. And like you said, we're recording this right at the end of the year. I was kind of looking back on my list of films that I kind of considered discoveries for the year. And one jumped out at me because I think the main connection it made in my mind was from that scene we were talking about earlier where it uses all this footage from World War II. And I was like, oh, well, here's this movie, which is made up almost entirely of like newsreel footage from World War II. And this is one of the most bizarre movies I've ever seen, but it was, I don't know, it charmed me. And it's very hard to find because this movie notoriously was released in 1976 and was in theaters for about 2 weeks and then got pulled because the critics just decimated it. And, you know, everybody was like, this thing is just weird and bizarre and terrible. And the studio pulled it, never to be seen again. I don't think it's ever had an official video release, but there was a copy floating around out there on YouTube that I watched earlier this year. And it's a film called All of This and World War II. And this is, the concept of this is just bizarre. Basically, they are telling the story of World War II through old newsreel footage and film clips from the era, all set to cover versions of Beatles songs. So you've got like folks like Elton John and Tina Turner and the Bee Gees and tons more doing these cover versions of classic Beatles songs. The one that always sticks out in my mind here from this movie is Peter Gabriel does a version of Strawberry Fields Forever. And this was actually, I think, the first song he recorded as a solo artist after he left Genesis. Yeah. And I'm a huge Genesis fan. So I've always found that to be intriguing. But the movie is just really, I don't know, it's strange, but it drew me in just in the way that it kind of is telling the story through the music and through this old newsreel footage. And of course, I find old footage like that to be endlessly intriguing. I just, you know, find that to be such an interesting corner of film history. And so it's interesting to see this footage from the actual events, but then also they intercut it with film clips from movies of the era that dealt with the war or dealt with what was going on here in the States or in Britain at the time. And so it's interesting to see how movies of the day were portraying the war itself. In fact, I was kind of watching this and going, give me a list of all the movies there are clips from in this thing, because I want to watch the actual full film. But it's one of those movies that when I was done watching it, I was like, who came up with this idea and what were they smoking at the time? Because this is just really, really strange. But in the end, the film is actually quite engaging and intriguing, and I don't think deserves the bad press that the critics gave it at the time. I'm sure one of the things that's holding it up, you know, that keeps it from having any kind of official releases, there's probably, I'm sure, all kinds of musical entanglements and such. Yeah. But if you do happen to stumble upon the copy that's floating out there on YouTube, I think it's a very interesting watch.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing. That's the 70s for you, though. You know, you just get all sorts. Everything was getting made in the 70s. You know, you just think, you know, not only who came up with that, but who did they pitch it to? And then and they just went, yeah, okay. But there is an era of experimentation in the 70s. There's all sorts of stuff being made, you know. I mean, Star Wars must have seemed like an insane prospect at the time. We're doing like a fairy tale in space, but it's going to be good, you know. It's going to be for kids, but no, everybody will like it. But it's I've wrote that down. because that sounds just a cup of my cup of tea. I really like that.
Excellent. Well, Lee, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and your various projects out there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure. It's always been a treat. You can find me at Twitter, because I still call it Twitter, @LovelyLee_G. The podcast Never Seen has got a Twitter account as well, which is @NeverSeen_pod. You can find the podcast at all of your usual, wherever you download your podcasts. But I tend to direct people to neverseenpod.podbean.com and have a listen to those and see what you make of those.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show. And I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that's going to do it for this episode of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read more reviews of Forgotten Films, you'll find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And please visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again real soon.
Let your mind join with us in the greatness of our quest. Serving the power of Atlantis.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.